This is Catherine Watt reading, doing another podcast reading. The last one I did was about a Supreme Court case, a dissent, and today I'm recording is December 13th, 2023, and I'm going to read a couple of pages from a G.K. Chesterton novel. The novel is called The Man Who Was Thursday, and Chesterton wrote it in, or published it in 1908. And I'm reading a couple of pages of an edition by Hendrickson Publishers Marketing, which was published, I can't see what year it was published, but the two pages that I'm reading, I'm doing under the fair use doctrine for educational or cultural purposes. And just for a little bit of background about the novel, it's a complicated setup, but the basic idea is that there's a group of anarchists, and there's a group of Scotland Yard police detectives, and they manage to infiltrate one another, and at a certain point early in the book, the part that I'm going to read is in chapter 4. At the point where one of the undercover detectives who has infiltrated the anarchist group, this is before he gets recruited, and he just meets a police officer on the street and gets into a conversation with the police officer about society and different things like that. So as I said, it's part of chapter 4. And the guy who's getting recruited, his name is Gabriel Syme, S-Y-M-E, and he starts off this part of the conversation saying, "But why did you join the police?" asked Syme with rude curiosity. "For much the same reason that you abused the police," replied the other. "I found that there was a special opening in the service for those whose fears for humanity were concerned rather with the aberrations of the scientific intellect than with the normal and excusable, though excessive, outbreaks of the human will. I trust I make myself clear." "If you mean that you make your opinion clear," said Syme, "I suppose you do. But as for making yourself clear, it's the last thing you do. How comes a man like you to be talking philosophy in a blue helmet on the Thames Embankment? You have evidently not heard of the latest development in our police system," replied the other. "I am not surprised at it. We are keeping it rather dark from the educated class, because that class contains most of our enemies. But you seem to be exactly in the right frame of mind. I think you might almost join us." "Join you in what?" asked Syme. "I will tell you," said the policeman slowly. "This is the situation. The head of one of our departments, one of the most celebrated detectives in Europe, has long been of the opinion that a purely intellectual conspiracy would soon threaten the very existence of civilization. He is certain that the scientific and artistic worlds are silently bound in a crusade against the family and the state. He has, therefore, formed a special corps of policemen who are also philosophers. It is their business to watch the beginnings of this conspiracy, not merely in a criminal but in a controversial sense. I am a Democrat myself, small d Democrat, and I am fully aware of the value of the ordinary man in matters of ordinary valor or virtue. But it would obviously be undesirable to employ the common policeman in an investigation which is also a heresy hunt." Syme's eyes were bright with a sympathetic curiosity. "What do you do then?" he said. "The work of the philosophical policeman," replied the man in blue, "is at once bolder and more subtle than that of the ordinary detective. The ordinary detective goes to pothouses to arrest thieves. We go to artistic tea parties. We go to artistic tea parties to detect pessimists. The ordinary detective discovers from a ledger or a diary that a crime has been committed. We discover from a book of sonnets that a crime will be committed. We have to trace the origin of those dreadful thoughts that drive men on, at last, to intellectual fanaticism and intellectual crime. We were only just in time to prevent the assassination at Hartle Pool, and that was entirely due to the fact that our Mr. Wilkes, a smart young fellow, thoroughly understood a triolet. "Do you mean," asked Syme, "that there really is as much connection between crime and the modern intellect as all that?" "You are not sufficiently democratic," answered the policeman, "but you were right when you said just now that our ordinary treatment of the poor criminal was a pretty brutal business. I tell you, I am sometimes sick of my trade when I see how perpetually it means merely a war upon the ignorant and the desperate. But this new movement of ours is a very different affair. We deny the snobbish English assumption that the uneducated are the dangerous criminals. We remember the Roman emperors. We remember the great poisoning princes of the Renaissance. We say that the dangerous criminal is the educated criminal. We say that the most dangerous criminal now is the entirely lawless modern philosopher. Compared to him, burglars and bigamists are essentially moral men. My heart goes out to them. They accept the essential ideal of man. They merely seek it wrongly. Thieves respect property. They merely wish the property to become their property, that they may more perfectly respect it. But philosophers dislike property as property. They wish to destroy the very idea of personal possession. Bigamists respect marriage, or they would not go through the highly ceremonial and even ritualistic formality of bigamy. But philosophers despise marriage as marriage. Murderers respect human life. They merely wish to attain a greater fullness of human life in themselves by the sacrifice of what seems to them to be lesser lives. But philosophers hate life itself, their own as much as other people's." Syme struck his hands together. "How true that is," he cried. "I have felt it from my boyhood, but never could state the verbal antithesis. The common criminal is a bad man, but at least he is, as it were, a conditional good man. He says that if only a certain obstacle be removed, say, a wealthy uncle, he is then prepared to accept the universe and to praise God. He is a reformer, but not an anarchist. He wishes to cleanse the edifice, but not to destroy it. But the evil philosopher is not trying to alter things, but to annihilate them. Yes, the modern world has retained all those parts of police work which are really oppressive and ignominious. The harrying of the poor, the spying upon the unfortunate, it has given up its more dignified work, the punishment of powerful traitors in the state and powerful heresiarchs in the church. The moderns say we must not punish heretics. My only doubt is whether we have a right to punish anybody else." "But this is absurd," cried the policeman, clasping his hands with an excitement uncommon in persons of his figure and costume. "But it is intolerable. I don't know what you're doing, but you're wasting your life. You must, you shall, join our special army against anarchy. Their armies are on our frontiers. Their bolt is ready to fall. A moment more, and you may lose the glory of working with us, perhaps the glory of dying with the last heroes of the world." "It is a chance not to be missed, certainly," assented Syme, "but still, I do not quite understand. I know as well as anybody that the modern world is full of lawless little men and mad little movements, but beastly as they are, they generally have the one merit of disagreeing with each other. How can you talk of their leading one army or hurling one bolt? What is this anarchy?" "Do not confuse it," replied the constable, "with those chance dynamite outbreaks from Russia or from Ireland, which are really the outbreaks of oppressed, if mistaken, men. This is a vast philosophic movement consisting of an outer ring and an inner ring. You might even call the outer ring the laity and the inner ring the priesthood. I prefer to call the outer ring the innocent section, the inner ring the supremely guilty section. The outer ring, the main mass of their supporters, are merely anarchists, that is, men who believe that rules and formulas have destroyed human happiness. They believe that all the evil results of human crime are the results of the system that has called it crime. They do not believe that the crime creates the punishment. They believe that the punishment has created the crime. They believe that if a man seduced 7 women, he would naturally walk away as blameless as the flowers of spring. They believe that if a man picked a pocket, he would naturally feel exquisitely good. These I call the innocent section. Oh, said Syme. Naturally, therefore, these people talk about a happy time coming, the paradise of the future, mankind freed from the bondage of vice and the bondage of virtue, and so on. And so all the men of the inner circle speak, the sacred priesthood. They also speak to applauding crowds of the happiness of the future and of mankind freed at last. But in their mouths, and the policeman lowered his voice, in their mouths, these happy phrases have a horrible meaning. They are under no illusions. They are too intellectual to think that man upon this earth can ever be quite free of original sin and the struggle. And they mean death. When they say that mankind shall be free at last, they mean that mankind shall commit suicide. When they talk of a paradise without right or wrong, they mean the grave. They have but two objects, to destroy first humanity and then themselves. That is why they throw bombs instead of firing pistols. The innocent rank and file are disappointed because the bomb has not killed the king. But the high priesthood are happy because it has killed somebody. And I bring this up and offer it as a podcast audio recording because it helps answer the question, why are the globalists, the monster, the families who own the central banks, however you construe them, why are they doing this mass murder program that has become more visible through COVID-19 and the public health emergencies, EUA, medical countermeasures programs? Because people often say, what are they going to have left if they kill off most of the people? Why would they want that? And the case can be made that they just want there to be fewer people so that they can have more stuff to themselves. But there's a way in which that doesn't make a whole lot of sense because they already have so much stuff. They can't possibly even use all the stuff that they have, the wealth that they have amassed for themselves. And this lens offered by Chesterton's writing gets at the idea that they're not only trying to kill and destroy the material world of people and human souls and human bodies, human families, human societies, and all of the physical systems that human beings depend on for food and for water and for social relationships with each other and meaningful work. They're destroying all of that. And if they're successful, they will also commit suicide themselves because their goal is destruction. There is not a creative element to what they're doing. And so thinking about it this way makes it easier to look at all the different excuses or cover stories that they give about climate change and about overpopulation and about pandemic preparedness and one world health and the empowerment of women, the eradication of poverty, all these things. Oh, energy scarcity, peak oil, debt bubbles, like financial chaos, basically. Those are excuses that they put forward for trying to persuade other people, I guess the people in the outer ring in that passage, that these murder programs and destruction of ecosystems and chemical spraying and everything else that they want to do to destroy the whole material universe that God has created and that God sustains. They're trying to persuade that outer circle that there's a justification for it, that it's leading to something better, that it's protecting something, and it's not. It's just about destruction. And it's just a cover story. And so understanding the deceit behind all those things helps people not participate in it and not believe it and go on with trying to protect and sustain human society and human families and human the countries that people live in as social entities and institutions, rather than help the globalists participate and carry out the destruction of all of these things. So again, I'm recording this on December 13th, 2023, and I read a passage from G.K. Chesterton's 1908 novel called The Man Who Was Thursday. Thanks.